I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Today, with the executive order I am about to sign, we will bring the change that so many scientists and researchers, doctors and innovators, patients and loved ones have hoped for and fought for these past 8 years. We will lift the ban on federal funding for promising embryonic stem cell research.
But what exactly does President Obama's reversal of President Bush's restrictions on embryonic stem cell research mean? Now, you'll remember the Bush ban limited federal funding to embryonic stem cell lines created before 2001 because harvesting new cells from discarded embryos at fertility clinics destroyed those embryos, and President Bush and others felt that destroyed life itself. But researchers said they needed new, fresh stem cell lines, and further, their work would improve lives. So they turned to private funding, and that meant they had to keep federally funded instruments like microscopes away from privately funded stem cell lines. Alice Park is science writer for Time magazine. And Alice, first of all, explain what Obama's executive order will do. Our understanding is that it will now allow for federally funded research, but will it allow for the creation of embryos for that research?
No, federal dollars cannot be used to create embryos for the sole purpose of research. And that is a law put in place in 1996 called the Dickey Wicker Amendment. So that forbids any taxpayer dollars from being used to create embryos solely for study purposes. What Obama's executive order will do will allow researchers now to access IVF embryos, which are going to be discarded. Those can then be used to generate stem cells, and in the process, of course, they will have to be destroyed.
These are in vitro fertility clinic embryos, as we said, that are slated to be thrown away anyway. Well, House Republican leader Eric Cantor said yesterday that Obama should focus on the economy, not on a debate over stem cells. Does Congress now have to act on any part of this, or is this a done deal?
Well, there are two elements to that. One is our understanding is that President Obama will now ask NIH to come up with a game plan, a guideline for directing how these taxpayer dollars will now be spent to fund embryonic research. Secondly, because this is an executive order, it can be overturned by his successor, just as Obama is overturning President Bush's executive order of 2001. So what Congress would like to do, of course, is to codify this and make it into law. And my understanding is that there is activity there so that they will make it into law, and therefore it cannot be overturned by the next president.
Well, in this economic time, though, is there money available for this research?
Well, I think that's the next issue. Is it's one thing to expand federal funding for embryonic stem cell research, but exactly how much will be available for that is another question, and something that the and certainly is going to be affected by the economy. NIH is, again, the largest funder of scientific research, and we know that NIH's grant budget has been shrinking in recent years. So how much of that already small pot is going to now be allocated to stem cell research remains to be seen. But I think this is something that, given, as President Obama has said, how many people could potentially benefit from the research that comes out of this field, is something that we need to take a look at and we need to support. And I think that's what he's doing here, regardless of what happens with the economy. It is the right thing to do in his perspective, and I think in many people's eyes, to help as many people as we can in coming years.
And how is the research community reacting? I mean, can you feel sort of a rush to research?
Well, there's certainly a lot of excitement and relief over being relieved of the burden of having to maintain, for many of the researchers who are, you know, who have continued to work on embryonic stem cell research with private funding, relief of the burden of having to maintain those double books and having to keep such close accounting. So now there's a feeling that, you know, yes, we can sort of let all that go and focus more of our energies on the science and on getting some of the advances that, we keep promising people. And let's really focus on the science and get some things into the clinic and get people well again.
Alice Park, science writer for Time magazine, thanks so much.
Thank you.
To our conversation today, and let's face it, the several generation-long conflict between the Tamil minority and the Sinhalese majority in Sri Lanka, which has taken more than 70,000 lives since 1983, has probably not been on your radar. In fact, many Americans were reminded of it or learned of it when a very pregnant MIA, an ethnic Tamil, sang at the Grammys. MIA sang a song from Slumdog Millionaire, but critics say in her own music, she uses coded lyrics in support of the militant group the Tamil Tigers. And today, experts in the region are wondering if she and other young Tamils around the world are being exploited by this sometimes ferocious militant group. MIA's father was a leader in the Tigers, which is labeled a terrorist organization by the U.S. and others. And as we speak, the Sri Lankan military has cornered the Tamil fighters in northern Sri Lanka. But tens of thousands of Tamil civilians are also trapped in the war zone with them, and humanitarian groups are concerned for their safety, as is Priya Sundaralingam. She's a junior at Winchester High School here in Massachusetts. She just took part in a 12-day hunger strike to bring attention to the plight of the Tamils. So, Priya, let's start with you. Are you inspired by MIA?
I listened to a couple of her interviews, and when she was in the region, her school was bombed. If she had gone to school that day, she would have been one of the dead girls that were in that bombing. So she said that she was speaking out as a Tamil civilian, someone who was lucky enough to escape the bombing. You know, what drives me to what I'm doing is because if my family wasn't lucky enough to get out of the region and I wasn't lucky enough to be born here, what's happening to the Tamil civilians right now, I would have been suffering the same exact fate. I cannot ignore that fact and carry on with the rest of my life. It's just not possible by me. I have to do something. I mean, I have grown up hearing what my family has been through, how they escaped the suffering. All of them had, or most of them, had escaped through little boats.
Well, as we said, the Tamil people are a minority in Sri Lanka. What's the conflict about?
The conflict is over language, basically. It's not over religion. It's over language, and it's over the area that we live in. I mean, Tamils mainly consist of the north and east, while Sinhalese mainly consist of the south.
But what do you think about the calls for, as the Tamil Tigers are calling for, a separate Tamil nation? Is that something that you support?
Well, if you look at it this way, the main goal of every Tamil civilian is that we want equality. Any Tamil, a dog has more rights than a Tamil civilian does. You know, we went to the capital a couple years ago, and, you know, we were advised to speak in English because if we spoke in Tamil, we had to watch our backs and make sure that Sinhalese mobs wouldn't stab us in the back. And so if that's happening in the capital, what is going on in the north and east where the war is actually happening in? I mean, they call it a war, but it's more of a genocide, and it's like a war against the Tamil civilians.
Well, what do you say about reports that the Tamil Tigers are actually preventing civilians from leaving that war zone?
If you look at it this way, this war has been going on for over 61 years. It's been 61 years now. Tamils started off with peaceful protests against the discrimination and violence that was committed against their ethnicity. They were gunned down. They were silenced.
So you feel the Tamil Tigers were forced to take this course. But, you know, they've used very brutal tactics, including suicide attacks, not just against the government, but against the Tamil people.
A lot of the reports about the suicide attacks against the Tamil civilians are sponsored by this government propaganda. There is complete chaos that's going on in the region. We haven't heard of some of our family in over 7 years.
What's that like, Priya? You know, your classmates are probably following, you know, the Celtics, or maybe they're listening to MIA.
I'm a Celtics fan, too.
Oh, well, you are, too, but as you look around you, you know people are not up in arms about the Tamil people. Is it frustrating, I guess? You know,
it's very frustrating. I have to educate people. When I bring up this issue, they go, well, what's Tamil? Mm-hmm. And so I have to explain that. And then they go, well, what's Sri Lanka? And many people do not know where Sri Lanka is.
That's Priya Sundaralingam. She's a junior at Winchester High School here in Massachusetts. Priya, thanks so much for speaking to us.
Thank you.
Well, let's bring in Zach Abuza. He's professor of political science at Simmons College here in Boston and specializes in Southeast Asian politics and security issues. And Zach, you know, you never know what's going on with young people today, but Priya is obviously a passionate defender of the Tamil minority in Sri Lanka. But I'm holding an email that she gave us. It was written by a Radcliffe fellow to Priya's high school after her hunger strike was publicized. And in it, this Radcliffe fellow writes that Priya is being brainwashed by the Tamil Tigers. And the email points to another young Tamil who set himself on fire, killed himself in front of UN headquarters in Geneva recently as proof that, you know, Priya might do something irrational herself. Now, Priya scoffs at that. The school, though, was concerned. They sent the Radcliffe email to Priya's mom, who, as we said, gave it to us. Now, your thoughts. Is Priya wrongheaded in her defense of the Tamils?
She's not wrongheaded in her defense of the Tamil civilians. Since independence, the Sinhalese majority have persecuted the Tamils. I mean, there is systematic and institutional prejudice in the country. The Tamils were denied educational opportunities, jobs in the civil service. And it really blew up by 1976 with the formation of the Tamil Tigers and all-out war in 1982. So she's not wrong in saying that Tamils are persecuted, but I caution her defense of the Tamil Tigers.
Well, and she skirted defending them, but she didn't denounce them. And
right.
You posted an article on the Tamil Tigers on counterterrorism.org recently. We'll link listeners to it at our website. You call them the most cutting-edge, adaptive, and creative terrorist organization in the world. This is stunning, some of their achievements. Tell us.
They've had a number of firsts, and they've employed more suicide bombings than Hamas and Hezbollah put together. They have a conventional force that at its peak had over 10,000 people. They had a network of arms suppliers. They purchased everything from small aircraft to were building their own submarines. They pioneered the use of suicide bombings of ships.
They pioneered the suicide vest. It's
yes.
been copied by a dozen organizations.
Yeah. The list goes on. They're a fanatical organization. They're incredibly well-disciplined.
Are they a terrorist organization? I mean,
absolutely. Without a doubt. And here's, you know, one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. They do have a conventional force, but they will use terrorism on a regular basis. They assassinated Rajiv Gandhi in 1991. They tried to assassinate the Sri Lankan president, Kumaratunga, in 1999, both with suicide operatives. They've blown up the Central Bank of Sri Lanka. They've blown up the World Trade Center in Colombo.
Now, here's some more. The Tamil Tigers at one point had their own navy. In 2001, they broke into an airport, destroyed three jetliners and more than 20 military aircraft. That's Zach Abuza. He's professor of political science at Simmons College. When we come back, though, we want to ask, for all that past glory, if you will, are the Tigers on the wane? And later today, why are there so many idling boxcars in small towns in the Midwest? Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. We're talking about the civil war in Sri Lanka, a multi-ethnic country located off the southern coast of India, to try to find out why a high schooler here in the U.S. would risk a 12-day fast to draw attention to it. Right at this moment, there's a standoff between the Sri Lankan military of the Sinhalese majority government and the Tamil Tiger rebels fighting for the minority Tamil rights. But tens of thousands of Tamil civilians are not trapped with the Tamil Tigers in a narrow strip of land in the northern part of Sri Lanka. The Tamil rebels have been fighting for an independent homeland after decades of what they claim is discrimination against them by Sri Lanka's Sinhalese majority. But the government argues it's been redressing an imbalance from colonial times when the Sinhalese majority accused the British government of giving preferential treatment to the Tamils. Well, earlier we spoke to a young Tamil American, a high school student who went on a hunger strike to show support for the Tamils. Right now we're speaking with Zach Abuza, professor of political science at Simmons College. And Zach, in a recent blog about the Tamil Tigers, you wrote that their revenue stream, the money they used to fund their huge, you know, operations in the past, is estimated to be $50 to $80 million a year. And the single most important revenue stream for the Tamil rebels is a baseline tax on the 800,000 Tamils in a diaspora, you know, Tamils who live in Canada, Australia, Great Britain, and here in the U.S. It's called the Tamil tax. Do you think Tamils in America, you know, are paying this tax and funding the Tamil Tigers?
Our knowledge, because the Tamils have never really targeted Americans and America has so few interests in Sri Lanka, they've really been off our security services radar screens. So I don't think we know so much about this. What we know about the Tamil tax is really from the Canadian and British and Australian police forces, simply because they have much larger and concentrated Tamil diasporas, and the Tamil Tigers have been much more active there. But clearly, they keep very close tabs on the Tamil communities overseas. They see them as a very important source of funding and support.
Well, it's not unlike when many Irish Americans would attend fundraisers and support the IRA, some unknowingly.
Sure.
And so it brings us around to, do you have concerns about the young people, MIA, the singer that we mentioned, and others getting maybe too emotionally involved in this issue? We've seen it before, young people supporting people in their homeland.
I think it's very hard for them to become detached and look at this objectively. Your previous interviewee spoke of the genocide. And there are egregious human rights against the Tamil community. I mean, the Sri Lankan military has been very abusive in the past. There have been many documented mass rapes of Tamil women. No one's going to defend the Sri Lankan military for their campaign in the past few decades. But to call what's happening there a genocide is really, it is not the systematic liquidation of a group of people. So I think they get too caught up and too emotional there. There is a real potential for a durable peace. The Tamil Tigers have ruled the North and Northeast for several decades. They are an authoritarian regime. They've killed thousands of fellow Tamils who preach moderation or seek to have just simply greater autonomy in Sri Lanka. They've really been brutal in their governance.
Oh, and where do you think we are now? As we said, there's a standoff between the Sinhalese Sri Lankan military and the Tamil Tigers, with all of these Tamil civilians caught in the middle. Do you see, for all that you said the Tamil Tigers achieved, quote unquote, mm-hmm. are they on the wane?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're down from controlling 20% of the country down to a few dozen square miles.
Is this the end that we're watching?
I think we are watching, and it's really remarkable because for years they fought the Sri Lankan military to a stalemate. They controlled much of the country. They were a de facto state, and since 2006, they've just imploded militarily. It's caught everyone by surprise.
But if the Tamil Tigers are on the wane, what happens to the Tamil civilians? I mean, is there a sense that the world will step in and say, okay, Sinhalese majority, you've won, but...
That's a great opportunity, and I'm not optimistic. I really feel that the Sri Lankan government could lose the peace in this one. In 2004, a top Tamil Tiger commander, Colonel Karuna, defected. And, you know, he turned over a vast swath of territory to the government, and they really did nothing for the Tamil community, tried to reconcile them and bring them back into the Sri Lankan body politic. After the December 2004 tsunami, you know, there was a flood of foreign aid in, and most of the most damaged areas were Tamil communities. And again, the aid was not spent very wisely. A lot of it was wasted. you know, the Tamil regions still remain poor, and the government is going to have to do two things. I mean, they're going to have to go in and really improve the standard of living for the Tamil communities. Second, they're going to have some sort of justice, post-conflict justice system, which also brings in their own military and security forces who have committed crimes. I mean, it can't just be a victor's court. And finally, they're going to have a very transparent political process that gives Tamils full political rights, full legal protections as a minority. I'm not confident they'll do this.
And how about the international community stepping in to, you know, get involved in the issue, as Priya and others hope they will?
I think the international community is so preoccupied right now with the financial crisis, this is a low priority. Hopefully, the Norwegian government, which sponsored the peace process in 2002 that broke down, will step in again. They have great moral authority to do so. But my real concern is, this is not 2002 when there was a battlefield deadlock. The Sri Lankan military is on the verge of winning, and that might make them feel less than willing to compromise.
That's Zach Abuza, professor of political science at Simmons College. By the way, his latest book is Conspiracy of Silence, The Insurgency in Southern Thailand and Its Implication for Southeast Asian Security. Zach, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Here's another taste of Tamil MIA. And still to come today, the song one critic called absolutely gorgeous. After the news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today only, fares $29 one way. Fly from Boston to San Diego, round trip for $200. Philly to Paris, just $290. Are you being inundated with ads for low-cost airfares? Are you wondering, are they as good as they sound? Well, let's find out. Carol Satilli is a travel writer for The Washington Post based in D.C. Carol, what are some of the fares you've seen?
Oh, there are some great sales right now. Air France, for example, has really good fares across the pond and onto Europe. The entire amount comes to $404. That's not bad.
Well, but you've been telling us that you have to be careful and be quick because some of them are one-day sales.
Oh, yeah. It's not as easy and as simple as it sounds. For the Air France sale, for example, it's only through early spring. It's not into the summer. It's the same for lots of these fare sales. They're very short-lived. Number one, you have to buy them really quickly. Like JetBlue had a great one the other day, which was $29 to New York and round trip to the West Coast for $200, but you only have one day to buy. So you have to be really fast. You have to be aware of what's going on out there.
And of course, we're getting used to the fact that you may have to travel on a certain day. What are the days du jour? What are the days now that are good for cut rates?
It's the days that you don't want to travel. Tuesdays and Wednesdays are basically your cheap days, which is, you know, historically, the days when the airlines don't have as many people on board, so they want to sell those seats. Load factors has a lot to do with it. How many seats have they sold, and how many do they have available?
Load factors. Let's talk about that. You know, how many people are on the plane? How do airlines react to that?
You would think that load factors would be way down because the economy is such a mess, but they're not, because what the airlines have done is that they've reduced capacity. So you might have still 77% load factor on U.S. Airways, for example, even though there's a lot fewer people flying.
And so because the plane is 77% full, you're less likely to get some kind of price cut
exactly.
On a flight. What about, you know, what else is affecting, though, some of these low fares we're seeing? Is it the lower oil prices or the recession somehow?
Well, the fuel surcharges have not been taken away. They've been folded into the prices. And a lot of people are very annoyed about this. It's like, wait a minute, fuel surcharges are still there, and yet fuel is nowhere near as high as it used to be. But the airlines got wise and they figured, hey, we could keep these fuel surcharges in, but we just won't call them that anymore. No. But they're still there.
Well, and are the prices as low as they seem? Because we've reported here on all the different fees that airlines are now charging, everything from checking luggage to, you know, asking for a pillow. When you factor those in, is the fare really that low?
That's a very good point, because I'm researching right now fares to St. Louis. So I find a $279 round-trip fare from here to St. Louis, And then I add two bags because I got to bring stuff for my daughter in college there, and suddenly I'm up to $3.59.
Yeah.
Then you add another $3-4 if you have a snack. So the way you get these cheap deals is to travel light and not eat once you get on the plane.
Well, you
bring your own sandwich.
There you go. And by the way, how do you find them? I mean, you're constantly looking, but are there certain websites that you recommend to get information on extra charges and deals?
TripAdvisor.com just started something new where they have a flight search, but the flight search will also add your fees in for you. So not only will you see what your price will be, but then you can plug in, I have one bag, I want an assigned seat, and it'll come up with a full fare for you, which is very good. I like that.
And finally, your thoughts on package deals. We saw an ad from Florida Theme Parks for airfare, hotel, 7-day pass to the park, $800, which is good. Do you think that the combination deals are the way to travel?
Make sure all your fees and taxes are included in that price.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times they don't include that. And then the next thing you do is you price out your components separately. You look at the package price, and then you go to your internet and you look up, okay, what's the airfare? What's the hotel? If I did this all separately, what would the price be? And then you decide whether it's a deal or not. One that has a great package deal right now is British Airways. It's called the Europe for Free deal. They throw in two free nights of hotel, and they have cheap airfares. So that's a good one right now.
By the way, just looking ahead, what do you think the future holds?
I think that you're going to see more and more of these short-lived, very targeted sales. And savvy travelers who are very flexible, who can travel on dates that other people might not be able to travel, and who can go short notice are going to get great deals. But if you need to travel in high season with your three kids, chances are you're not going to get those really, really cheap fares.
Carol Sottile, travel writer for The Washington Post, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And coming up, the boxcar in the backyard, here and now. Welcome back to Here and Now. How do you see a recession? In some towns, it could be vacant storefronts and mosquito-infested pools behind foreclosed homes. In others, it's freight trains. Take Newcastle, Indiana, about 50 miles east of Indianapolis. A little over a year ago, residents started to see idle yellow freight cars pop up. Now there's a mile-long line of them. It's because in a good economy, a rail line, like, say, Union Pacific, might have 5,000 to 8,000 freight cars in storage. Today, it has 48,000 freight cars that aren't pulling anything across the country. So where to put them? Well, in towns like Newcastle, Indiana. Bruce Atkinson grew up there. He works there now and lives nearby. Bruce, these freight cars are close to 20 feet tall. What's the impact on people who live nearby to have these freight trains right there? And how close are they?
Gosh, they're probably maybe 30 feet from the sides of some of the houses. Just to give you an idea, there's several places here where they block the sun out so that people's backyards are dying.
Right. Well, you've made some videos. You've gotten so frustrated about this. You've made some videos and put them on YouTube. I've got one here. I'm going to roll it.
Sure.
It's just got a music bed, as we'll hear, but I'll describe what we're seeing, and you help me along here.
Sure.
Okay, well, there they are. Oh, they are quite tall. They're as tall as that pretty white shuttered house next to it.
Yeah.
Well, they've got writing all over them, don't they?
Yeah, they've got a lot of graffiti on them.
And some of the graffiti we really can't discuss.
No, some of it's really not suitable for a family-oriented show.
But are some of these freight trains where children play?
Oh, yeah. This is through a residential area. These are middle-class families. You know, they've got kids, and the kids play in their neighborhood.
In a town that's already had some problems, we understand it used to be home to a Chrysler factory.
Yeah.
Chrysler left. A machine shop moved in, but then cut wages. Unemployment at its highest in over a decade, just around 9%.
Yeah.
So how do these trains, these graffiti-covered trains, feel?
Well, let me just put it this way.
Yeah.
If you woke up every morning and looked out your front windows, you were drinking coffee, and you saw this big monstrosity, and by the way, they're actually a double-decker auto haulers, and you look out your window, and that's what you see every morning for a year. It would be kind of depressing to me, you know. I mean, especially if you're used to seeing, you know, looking out across there and seeing your neighbor. There's one instance, and this is probably the most compelling story. There's a lady here in town, and she lives on one side of the tracks, and her sister lives on the other side of the tracks. Her sister is legally blind, and
As you know, the Federal Railroad Administration says the owners of the tracks have the right to store the cars there unless there's
that's
some...
true. If you don't mind, I'd like to say that I really don't have anything against trains. But the situation is these train cars set, and they've been setting for a year. And yes, he has every right to store these train cars here. But just because you've got legal rights to do something doesn't make it right to infringe on other people's lives.
That's Bruce Atkinson, who grew up in Newcastle, Indiana, has been making YouTube videos to draw attention to the 100 or so yellow freight cars sitting through the middle of town. Again, I'm looking at the video now. They go block after block and get uncoupled at crossroads so that, you know, there's a street that might go through and then block after block after block. Bruce, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, let's turn to the owner of those tracks. He's Spencer Wendelin, an executive with C&NC Railroad in Indiana. They own the tracks, not the cars. He charges different freight car owners to park on his tracks. And Spencer, we were just hearing from Bruce Atkinson. As you well know, he's one of the residents upset about the freight cars being there. But he says you have every right to do this, but he just wishes, you know, that maybe you wouldn't. What would that mean for you if you didn't do this?
Well, I think one has to understand why those cars are there. The particular cars that are in question in this case happen to be cars that are designed to haul automobiles. And I think most everybody in the country is aware that there are not a whole lot of automobiles being made or sold right now, and so the cars are idled. They have to put them someplace, so they look for places to store them. We happen to have space available, so we're storing them there.
Do you have any other space available? You know, are there any other tracks that don't cut a town in half, a town that's already feeling idled itself, you know, and now they have these idle trains?
Well, I think one has to understand that Newcastle is not being picked on. There are cars in every community in the United States being stored right now because the economy is down so much. And it's not just automobile cars. There are grain cars being stored. There are gondola cars, which usually haul scrap metal, being stored. There are box cars being stored.
Well, we hear about a town in Colorado that also was inundated with these idle box cars, and they protested, and the box cars were moved. So, you know, the question is, can they just even go a mile outside of town? Do they have to go right through the middle of town?
Well, unfortunately, the situation is this, that you have to store cars on tracks that are not being used to move trains currently. Mm-hmm. Those tracks tend to be where industry was built, and almost all industry has, over the history of this country, has been built in communities. So
right.
We're using the tracks that are available, as are a lot of other people.
And as we said, there used to be big industry, a Chrysler factory in Newcastle, but now that's gone, so these tracks are idle.
Well, that's not entirely a one-for-one connection, but yes, obviously that particular plant was involved in the automobile industry, and the fact that it's been diminished markedly. There was another major automobile parts manufacturer on that same rail line that's now out of business. I mean, another way of looking at those cars is it represents a whole lot of people that are out of work right now because they're not working, making cars.
Well, even the mayor of Newcastle says, well, they are rail cars and they're sitting on a railroad. The two sort of go together. You know, there's of course, some business sense to that. But since you are, you know, making some money, that's what you do. You have these tracks and you charge people to park the cars on them. Why not give a percentage of that back to the town? Maybe there's something they could do, plant trees or do something.
Well, our company pays taxes just the same as every other company that's in business.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I could say we are giving something back to the town.
Do you have any idea when the cars might move?
Not really. I mean, if somebody can come by and tell me when the automobile companies are going to make automobiles and people are going to start buying them again, then I can probably give a better answer to that question.
Well, they could be there a long time. You were quoted in the Wall Street Journal as saying that the rail line was there before the houses were.
Yes, portions of that line have been there for 129 years, other portions for 146 years.
Now, this is the Wall Street Journal reporter's words, that you have little sympathy for the angry residents, again, because the rail was there before the car. Is that sort of a public relations problem for you? I mean,
well,
do you have
say it's a public relations problem. That's his analysis of my conversation with him.
Do you want to set the record straight?
Well, I mean, obviously, there are a lot of people, including the owners of those cars, people that make automobiles and are now out of work, and the automobile companies that are borrowing billions of of taxpayer dollars that would much rather have those cars moving to transport automobiles to people who are going to buy them, but they're not. So the alternative is they have to store them someplace so they are available when the economy returns to the point where they need them.
That's Spencer Wendelin, an executive with CNNC Railroad in Corydon, Indiana. He owns the tracks that run through the town of Newcastle, and those tracks now hold idling freight cars. Spencer, thanks for speaking with us.
No problem. Happy to do it.
Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, some Harvard Med students are saying drug companies have too much influence on professors, but at least one professor says those companies pay for your research. We'll wait in tomorrow. Coming up, singer-songwriter Ann Heaton, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
We welcome you back with a song the New York Times called Absolutely Gorgeous. What do you think?
I'm ready to be afraid. I'm ready to jump. I'm ready to let you hurt me if you
It's called Jump. It's the opening track on Blazing Red, a new CD from singer-songwriter Ann Heaton. And Ann joins us in the studio. Welcome. It is gorgeous. I mean, when you have a song like that, do you know you've got a little bit of the zeitgeist or something?
It feels good. I mean, I even like to listen to it.
You even like to listen to it?
I do, even though it's mine.
With a rave review for your own music, if you can stand to listen to it. But what does it mean for you, by the way?
Well, this album is a lot about making transitions or changes, sometimes foundational changes. And in Jump, I did use some personal experience, but I tried to broaden it so that people could find themselves in the music as well.
Let's talk about you. You've gone from classical to gospel to jazz with Max Roach. We want to talk about that. Started taking piano lessons when you were just three. You were trained in classical music and awarded a scholarship, at least a part scholarship, to the Berklee College of Music here in Boston. But we understand you turned that down. Why?
I did. The scholarship was contingent upon me continuing to play classical piano. And at that point, I knew I wanted to be a songwriter and approach the piano in a new simpler way.
And so you didn't want to just be a pigeonholed in classical music.
Right. I didn't think it would be worth it. And they have great songwriting classes there, but yeah. I didn't want to.
Well, and you still, you know, retain the right to put classical, at least sounding things on your CD. There's a minute snippet of music. Let's just listen. This is Strings OV. Now, what's this doing on the CD?
This actually is the result of a mistake, a beautiful mistake. This was a string arrangement that went under the song Pieces of Me, and I kept hearing it and something sounded wrong with the melody. So we kept soloing it in the studio. I was like, I don't think that note's in the chord. It sounds really weird. But because we kept soloing it, which means you just hear the strings, I realized it was so beautiful on its own that I thought, well, we have to take it out of the song, but let's keep it on the record.
So, continue your story. You leave the piano for a while, go to singing and songwriting, and then had what you describe as an epiphany when you joined the choir at Grace Congregational Church in Harlem, Well, tell us about that.
That was an amazing experience. I was taking a few music classes at City College, and I met a choir director who invited me to come sing in this gospel choir. And I just learned all this music that I had not known before, like Motherless Child or Wade in the Water, early American music and gospel music.
This is quite a popular church, too, we should say. I mean, some people go on tours to this church. It's got a beautiful choir.
They have an amazing choir, yeah. John Motley is the choir director there. And then he actually was a friend of Max Roach's, which is how I ended up taking that tour.
Ah, and so now you're touring with drumming legend Max Roach. This is in the 90s, touring through Europe. What was that like, by the way?
It was incredible. I learned a lot from Max because he was so calm. There was always a lot of activity, and were we going to learn the music in time? And it sort of seemed like we weren't, you know? But it seemed like he just trusted everybody. And I think that because he trusted everybody, he got the best musicianship.
Are we hearing a little of his influence on You Are My Only Way Out Is In? Or is that just a percussive song?
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, it was a segue.
So. Yeah, I know. I'm like, I don't know how to answer that one. That's my version of the blues, but I don't know where it came from.
Let my heart be as big.
Open about a lot of personal things on this record, even though you said you masked them a little bit. You're 36 years old. Another song on the CD is called Mama to You. You're not expecting. You're expecting to be expecting in a future time.
That's a great way of putting that. I'm not yet a mom, but I would like to be a mom at some point. You know, there was a period of time when I stopped doing the writing in the morning, like the morning pages, and I thought I wanted to try something a little different that I wasn't quote-unquote supposed to be good at. So I was drawing with crayons in the morning just to sort of open myself up. And one morning, I wasn't really paying attention, but when I looked down, I had drawn myself pregnant, and I thought, oh, wow, you know, I wonder what that means.
People talk about motherhood and the love of motherhood, but people rarely talk about fears, you know, of motherhood. I mean, and this is so honest. Let's listen.
Could you wait a little bit longer? Every day I get stronger. I heal those hurts deep inside. I make room so I can make a life. So I can be mama.
Honest.
Yeah, and just the idea of healing yourself before you bring another life into the world, or learning how to love yourself, you know, like the airplane, put the mask on yourself first before you put it on your child.
That's right. That's singer-songwriter Anne Heaton. Her new CD is Blazing Red. For more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Anne, so many pretty tunes on the CD. Do you mind? We want to hear more of Jump, which we started with.
No problem.
Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
And we'd like to take just a second to thank you for taking the plunge with us. Today we welcome new listeners from Michigan Radio, serving Ann Arbor, Detroit, Flint, and Grand Rapids. Also Digital KUT2, Austin 90.5 in Texas. And Northwest Public Radio, serving Washington State and the Tri-Cities, as well as Pullman, Moses Lake, Walla Walla, Mount Vernon, Omak, and Yakima. I love saying Yakima. We'll work hard to deserve your attention. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.